Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough Directions. Each week, Breakthrough Directions explores the two faces of your business, outward through marketing and client delivery, and inward, your vision, profit model, systems, team, and you, so you can grow a business you love and live the life of your dreams. Welcome to the show.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Breakthrough Directions here on Blog Talk Radio. I am Gina Gaudio-Graves, the host of the show, calling in live this week from Bonita Springs, Florida, as I do each week on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. We've got another great guest and great show planned for all of you. We have my co-host, Linda Feinholt, the founder of the Breakthrough Academy at BreakthroughByDesign.com. Linda's calling in live from Los Angeles, California. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Gina. How are you?
I am wonderful, and you?
I am doing really well, and I'm so excited for the conversation we're having with our guests today. You know, so often we talk about the passion that people are driven by to make a difference in the world, and most of the time here on this show, you and I are talking, Gina, to people who are focused on for-profit businesses, passion-driven, experience-launched, and so on. And in my conversations with today's guest, Katie Vernoy, I really thought, you know, so many people don't understand what the concept of a not-for-profit endeavor is, and the fact that if you don't care about it as much as if it were a for-profit endeavor, you may not have your doors open the next day or the next year. And I thought, you know, I want Katie to come share her learnings and her experience with us and with our audience today. So, Katie, welcome.
Thank you.
So, you know, a little bit of background for our listeners. You're a management consultant. You're based here in Los Angeles, working with individuals and teams and companies in order to develop and implement really innovative programs, while at the same time holding a really structured and efficient foundation for them in business. And so let's explain to our listeners, at the core of it, when we talk about nonprofit, what is it in your experience that we're talking about? What's the range and variety of what we're talking about when we say a nonprofit or not-for-profit endeavor?
There's a huge range. I mean, there's kind of small nonprofits that have a specific cause that they're behind, and they can be, you know, a few people that are pursuing something that they are really passionate about and become a nonprofit. Most of the nonprofits I've worked with, though, are actually at the other end, where they're large nonprofits. They've got lots of government funding, grants, donors who are pursuing a lot of different types of programs. My background actually is as a therapist, and so most of them have been in mental health related fields. And really that's, you know, obtaining money either through kind of Medicaid, Medi-Cal kind of services, as well as with other grants to provide mental health services, which as we know are very needed to folks that can't afford it. And so there's many different types of nonprofits like that, but there's a huge range of services. And what that means is that there's specific programs that are funded specific ways with specific contracts. And so you have to match what the contract says in order to get the funding in order to provide the services.
It's a really interesting issue that you're describing, because for-profit businesses can go to the bank and say, here's my business plan, or go to investors and say, here's my business plan, and this is what I intend to do in the business, this is the return on investment I'm intending to create, and so on. It actually works differently when you're a nonprofit, and you continuously must keep going back year after year, and as you were just describing, having actual contracts that you've got to report the results of in order to get your next tranche of funds or to get additional funds for a new program. It's really quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very different. And I think that the biggest difference is that you are given a specific pot of money. or a specific funding source that you have to then comply with a lot of rules and regulations. And that wasn't always the case. I mean, when I first started a nonprofit, there was a pot of money and there was kind of some general rules, but people were kind of just testing it out, seeing what was going on. And as we know, 2008 hit the for-profit businesses, and that kind of ricocheted, you know, or rippled, I mean, later on into nonprofits, and the regulations on the funding became very tight because it was very hard for folks to, you know, there's just not a lot of money coming in. There's not a lot of tax dollars. You know, the economy's been depressed for a while. And so then all of a sudden there's these huge, huge limits on what money can be spent for. And so kind of circling back around to your question, it's this idea that you have to seek out specific programs with specific parameters, say, hey, I can do this, and this is how I prove that I can do this, and this is the budget I need, and then they tell you how much they're actually going to give you. And then you have to then work within that amount. I was actually working with a program where we blew out the top of it because we had, you know, been working to increase our kind of maximizing our budget and didn't realize, oh, hey, we're going to go above. And in a for-profit company, it's like, great, we're making more money. In a not-for-profit, you know, that means that you can't provide services because nobody's going to pay for it because you have a budget. And so it's a very different thought process. You can be innovative within that, but you have very specific parameters around the contract, and you also have a max of how much you can spend. It's not like, oh, keep selling. It's, okay, we need to limit it within this very fine range so that we match our budget as closely as possible.
You know what I would love to do? I'd love to peel back the lid on what you were just describing as a case study for people to understand, because I think it would be of enormous value for it to become even more clear to people that it's literally going to a new mindset and new action plans when you're dealing with a nonprofit. So, for instance, when you joined the organization of that particular case study, what was the situation when you walked in the door to that particular organization and its circumstances?
Well, when I joined a team that was working on a very specific program within South Los Angeles. We were working to provide mental health services to remove mental health barriers to employment. And it's a program that has a lot of different funding streams that come into it. There's Department of Mental Health, which is an LA County offshoot of the state that I think is Department of Health Services now or something. More detail probably than you want. But there's also Department of Public Social Services. So there's a lot of heads looking at it. And so I joined it at the service provider level. I was a therapist providing services. And what we were finding and what I, you know, kind of found out through my experience was that we weren't maximizing our budget because clients didn't want to come in. And so there was a lot of therapists that were working to do a lot of the stuff. They were running around. And it was just, it wasn't working. And so I had ideas. So thankfully, they promoted me to manage that team. And what we did is we took it from almost losing the program because we weren't using enough of the money. And and with a not-for-profit, if you don't use the money by the end of the fiscal year, you don't get it. It goes away, and they may lower your budget the next year. And so it's very, you know, you need to make sure that you're using it. The other thing is that because there were so many eyes looking over the program, there was a lot of they were looking at compliance. And so if you're not in compliance with the contracts, which, you know, especially if it's a government contract, there's a lot of bureaucracy. But there's paperwork that has to be done at this time and this kind of communication and all that stuff. And we were out of compliance. It was not good. And the other piece was that we were just kind of barely getting by. So when I came into management, I was given very specific directive. Let's just fix this thing because we want to keep the program. It's a really great program helping folks get off welfare and back to work. And so what we did as a team is we worked to figure out how can we become really efficient, because my experience with not-for-profits is that they really don't think about it as a business. They think about it as a passion. I think that there's been a shift with that, especially with the tightening of all the budgets and the parameters around how you get the money because it's so tight. But especially then, it was like, let's just do this. We love helping people. Let's just do this. And there wasn't a lot of real thought in how to do it. I had service providers who get paid to do therapy or do case management or whatever who are running around faxing things and, you know, trying to organize their paperwork and all of that stuff. And so we really looked at how can you separate out the clerical from the services and whose role fits into what. And it was like a huge shift in mindset. But once we were able to do that and got really efficient, the program started running itself. It was really easy because it was like, okay, this is what we have to do. Here's the contract parameters. Here's what that looks like. Here's how we can divide that out. I mean, getting an administrative assistant, a part-time administrative assistant, was like revolutionary for this program. And we were able to then get super efficient. Therapists and case managers were able to provide those services. And then we were like, okay, so we're providing the services, but our clients are still hesitant to come in. What can we do? And so then we were able to get really innovative. And we were talking about, you know, different types of programs and different types of offerings and different types of relationships with our clients to help them come in and really get what they needed. Because we knew we had great services to offer, but if nobody was coming in to get them, then this is the same as a for-profit. But if nobody's coming to get our services, we can't have really our passion-driven business work. And so it was really fun. I had a great team of people who were, you know, very creative, willing to try stuff out. And so then we were able to then say, okay, within the parameters of this contract, how much can we really innovate? What can we do? And so we tried some group therapy programs. We tried some different, you know, transportation to help folks get to places. We went out to people's homes. I mean, it was pretty exciting, but and all of it had to fit in within the parameters of the contract. And so once we did that, and all of this is happening in the first year that I'm managing this program, by the way. By the end of the year, we had another audit from the county, and we got 98%, which was awesome. It was so exciting. We also had maximized our contract and needed more money. So that one was something where we had to rely on the benevolence of the county. They did provide us with some more money, which was very nice. And then we also got an award for innovative best practices, which then helps the county turn things around and really look at, as a county, how can we provide the best services. But it really is taking, okay, how do we bill to the contract so we're not going over? How do we create great services so we have clients coming in? Because we can't bill for a service if a client's not there. And so, I mean, that's similar to for-profit, but we also have to make sure that we, you know, decrease our billing once we start getting close to the contract's max. And then we also really have to look at how can we be efficient, because, more billing doesn't mean more money necessarily if we max out the contract. So you have to really, how do you work on very tight, you know, tight budget limits. I mean, I was joking with my team that I would tell them, bill, wait, no, back it down, you know, so that we could make sure that we didn't go over, but we needed to spend it all. We were actually fairly successful with that. One year we got in within $10, which was amazing. But it was something where it took some really close management, because it's not like you can run away and just bill forever, but you also can't, you know, kind of say, oh, we'll do enough, it'll be fine, because you don't get the money if you don't spend it.
It's so important, all of the things that you were just describing, because if we lay them out side by side next to a for-profit business, the strategic thinking that went on is as necessary in both types, both styles of business. The systematization of getting work done, getting it done effectively and productively, same issue in both businesses. The team, the criticalness of getting the right roles and responsibilities, getting the work divvied up in a way that can be done most productively, most efficiently, I'll say most profitably. Same thing on both sides, as you described, with getting even a part administrative assistant. So powerful. And here's the irony, that in a nonprofit, you know from the first day of the year, the first day of the contract, that you have one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake. It's not optional.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a for-profit business, the perspective is, how effectively can I spend what I'm willing to budget in order to grow the business, because I want to keep bringing in more clients and more customers and more people that are being helped by my products and programs and services. And it's the message is more and more and more, but in the nonprofit, you can't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way you can grow is to get more different contracts, try to negotiate your contract higher, but you have to show that you can be responsible with the money that you have. And so to spend out of control and max out your budget too early, depending on how that plays out, could actually harm me because they're not going to want to say, oh, here's another tiny little pot of money. We'll trust that you won't max it out and then leave our consumers in the lurch. They want to make sure that you're going to be responsible with it. You know, there's intensive looking at budgeting at a nonprofit, where I think with a for-profit, there's a little leeway because as long as you're covering your bills, you just want to keep growing like crazy. More money is more money, whereas for not-for-profits, it could really mean, you know, okay, we maxed out our budget in half the year, and now we can't provide any services to anyone. And so we've got employees that don't have money they don't have a job because there's nothing to bill. And there's, you know, clients, which in the mental health field, you know, if these clients in the mental health field are, you know, left to their own devices, you know, for some of them they'll be fine, and some of them this is what they need to really survive. And so it's there's this additional layer of kind of really responsible management of a pot of money, and so it can be really, really key to be very strategic in how am I spending my money and what are other avenues so that I can grow my nonprofit. And it's through, you know, donors and grants and other contracts and stuff like that. But you have to get them. You can't just, you know, kind of hit the gas pedal and hope for the best.
Right. And I think part of what you're so well describing for our listeners is that in the nonprofit world, you actually have many customers, many clients that mm-hmm. you have to be serving, that have expectations, both the funders, the donors, and the people who will be getting the services. You can think of with that hat on of these are, in a sense, clients who have to be served as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a lot of different people that you're serving. Mostly in the organization I was working with, the donors were county. Level, or not donors, the funders were county. So it was the Department of Mental Health, the Department of Public Social Services, the Department of Children and Family Services, the Department of Probation. And so those funders all have a say, and if you get a contract that has more than one of them, you might have, you know, a lot of different parameters. And so that's kind of one person that is your customer, so to speak. The other customer, and a lot of times, especially because nonprofits are very passion-focused and mission-focused business, is the customers, you know, the clients or the participants or the, you know, the families. There's a lot of different names that we use in the places that I've worked with. And those are the people that you want to serve as best as you can. And so there's that kind of back and forth of, okay, do they qualify? How do I help them qualify for services? Because there's a lot of specific parameters on who can be your clients because of, you know, do they meet this criteria or that kind of stuff. And so helping to kind of match clients to the services and linking as many people as possible, but then also providing services that are of high quality to them. And so especially with like Department of Children and Family Services and Department of Probation, there's a lot of love given to these families, both from the departments as well as the specific, you know, kind of contractors that are doing the work, saying, okay, how can we best utilize the system to serve your needs? How can we provide you with the support you need to have your family be successful, to have your child be successful? And it's there's a lot of different places to really look for stuff. I mean, there's also kind of at the federal level, a lot of mental health services anyway, come through Medicaid, and in California that's called Medi-Cal. And so there's parameters set at the federal level, which then the state has to interpret, then the counties then enforce because they get the money. And so we have to kind of match up to all of those things. And then, you know, there's always that kind of tweaking and adjusting and getting creative, because in truth, everybody wants to serve the most amount of people as possible, but we have to kind of meet each need in each place. And so it's very complex. And it's a lot of fun because, you know, there's a lot of guidance. It's how do I, you know, make all the pieces match so that at the end of the day, I'm doing quality services that are meaningful to me, that are truly getting results, you know?
I do. You know, Gina, you and I talk so often about the role of any business is to serve its ideal customer. And you also, Gina, I know, are very involved with nonprofits, and I'd love if you'd share some of those, because while we've been talking from a perspective of, you know, health services, mental health services, and the need there, the reality is that nonprofits come in all these different sizes and shapes. They come in the shape of, you know, scholastic foundations to help students. They come in, you know, I'm thinking for a moment because I have some colleagues who work with the Getty Foundation, which is all about art, where the Getty Foundation documents literally said how much of the foundation must be spent every year on art purchases and so on. So it's such a different complexion than just a for-profit, isn't it, Gina?
It really is. I often talk about social entrepreneurship and the idea of doing good in a for-profit business rather than having to only do good in a nonprofit business. So I tend to attract a lot of nonprofit businesses who really want to learn more about social entrepreneurship and how it can benefit them. But I've been chuckling to myself as I've been listening to the conversation, because this is so true. The folks that I work with in nonprofits, they come from such a place of service that when I suggest to them things that could change how they do things ever so slightly, they really can't even wrap their minds around it. Just a good example. One of the nonprofits I work with is an organization called the Gridiron Alliance that is in the process of rebranding themselves as the Community Alliance for Sports Safety. And until recently, their focus has been their mission. Their mission is to help those high school athletes, specifically football players, that have sustained what they call catastrophic injuries. In other words, athletes that have had injuries resulting in quadriplegia and paraplegia. If we look at high school and college athletes in all sports, there's almost 500 such injuries every year, which is a lot. So they're rebranding themselves as an organization that advances sports safety so that it's no longer just about helping the 100 to 500 kids a year that get injured. And they really get what it means to serve. So if they're going to go after this sports safety idea, I came up with this fantastic suggestion to borrow from what we do in for-profit businesses and hold a series of workshops for coaches, athletic trainers, and even the athletes to teach them what they need to know about sports safety. And in doing that, ask people to come into these workshops with a donation of something small, say $50. Well, that could have generated so much extra revenue for this particular organization. Yeah, they can't think about it that way. They're thinking that they're just going to let anybody who wants this wonderful training to come in for free. And then because they've got more people coming into their world, they can then go to more companies and ask for donations. It's just a totally different mind shift, a totally different paradigm. How would you coach them to overcome that?
I think it's something where my experience with nonprofits as well as people that got into their business because they want to help people is looking at how do you sustain, because it's great if you want to help people, but if you can only help them for a year, or if you only can help them for a little while, or you can only help a certain number of people because you can't get the scope, you're really not helping people. And so even though it seems painful to charge for training that you think people absolutely need, it's something where you want to figure out what does that get you? You know, what would that money get you, and how does that money really support expanding the mission bigger than you could do with just seeking out donations from local businesses or all of those things? I'm actually working for a school right now who has been able to get some donors for a long time but hasn't created a a specific donor program that kind of advertises who's donating, what's going on, and they're having that same shift right now, too, is looking at, okay, if we want to expand this great innovative program that we're doing here, because it's working with kids with autism spectrum disorders, if we want to expand that and become a training center and doing all these things, we have to get more money in. And so we have to look at how do we market and brand with ourselves, and how do we, you know, provide all these different pieces if we don't have money? Because it's not going to happen if you don't have some sort of budget to do it. And so it's a hard shift. And I have it with some of the mental health providers, because I do career counseling for mental health providers too. And some of the mental health providers are healers or practitioners. They're not business owners. And it's like, no, you are a business owner. You're not going to help anybody if they don't know you're here, and if you don't have, you know, the wherewithal to stay. It's great if you're providing, you know, free services, but you can do that after you've made enough money to live.
That's a great suggestion. I'm going to try that this week.
It's just hard, because my experience has been when people are driven by passion and they're really about, I want to help people, or I want to help this specific, you know, this is my cause. And a lot of people will come from a place of their own experience or something that just really moves them deeply. It can lead to this experience of everything for the client, the chosen client, the one that the nonprofit is for. And so I would have meetings that people weren't showing up for because they had to deal with a client matter or they had to do things. It was the business always came second. It wasn't the planning and the strategy and the money and all of those pieces had to really be put into management, because and even then sometimes, you know, they didn't show up because it was about the love of the community or the love of this type of client or this type of thing, and it becomes, it's almost kind of a badge of honor that I'm spending a million hours doing this thing because I love it, but, you know, I can't pay my rent.
Oh, I get that so much. Welcome to my world. It's too funny. And the other thing that has really helped me with many nonprofits is when they can really see that when they're out there giving away, especially training, to the people that they think want it, who are really the people who need it, that don't necessarily even know they want it, when they just give it to them for free, almost never do they actually use it in the way that it is intended. And if you're really doing it that way, are you even serving to the best of your ability? And when I can get an organization to really understand that and to realize that even if they're asking for a $5 or $10 donation to get the training, people are much more likely to actually use it the way that it was intended to get the results that they wanted for them, that almost always makes a huge difference with the nonprofits I work with. Just hasn't in this one particular case yet.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, is my experience working with folks that have Medi-Cal, which basically means that they can get services for free. And my, you know, as well as anything that's provided for free, is that it's not valued as highly. And people aren't as likely to attend because they haven't put forward any money for it. And so you have to create the value for it. Otherwise, people are they're not going to come. They're not going to take the information in the way that it's intended. I think, you know, even though it doesn't necessarily feel good for some folks to charge for something they want to give away for free, it can create some value in the mind of the participants.
Absolutely. And, you know, everything we teach at Directions University, we tell our students, it's not enough to just go out and serve to the best of your ability. It's really about serving to the best of your ability and strategically monetizing at the same time. And so the model that I've created, I call it the vortex model of doing business. And it really is a vortex. We think about a tornado or a whirlpool as a vortex. The idea is to build a strategic plan that when someone comes into your world through the outer edges of your tornado, makes it very likely that they're going to get sucked into the center of the tornado, which is in that place that makes you the greatest amount of money. And when you put this plan in place, once it's there, you really can trust it, go out and just serve to the best of your abilities, because it takes care of the monetizing piece for you. And it works whether you're a for-profit, a non-profit, whatever kind of business it is, it works every time. But too often with the nonprofits, they want to rush into the cause, the passion, that thing that they really want to accomplish, and skip over building that plan. And so they don't have that backup piece for the strategic monetization, and therefore can't do as much good in the world and all the other things that come along with it.
I think even the term strategic monetization, I think, would send nonprofit folks quivering in their boots, because it just doesn't line up.
It does for mine, for sure. Absolutely. Every time.
So I think it's something where the importance of strategic planning is really critical for nonprofits, because a lot of contracts only come around once a year, and so they really have to think very strategically on what they can do and how they can serve their community. And you know, there's usually a big donor event. There's usually a lot of different ways that people can dip stuff. And I think one way to really make sure that people are strategically monetizing is having a good, you know, development department, whether it's, you know, somebody that's focused on grant writing or donor or plan giving or any of that kind of stuff, because if you have a passion for it, then someone else does too, and you can find them and you can really get that really kind of monetizes things, and it puts it on, you know, on a specific person who can actually, you know, go out and take care of that, while the passion-driven folks whose skill set is providing service or training or whatever can go out and do that and not have to worry about it so much. But with contracts, those and grants, those are something where it's clear that you're going to have to kind of promote yourself, which can be hard for nonprofits, and it's also clear that you're going to have to promise things. And if it's and I've had people who kind of go along, and they are thinking, hey, you know, we're doing okay, but we really are barely staying afloat. You know, we've had to work on really tight staffing, so a lot of people are getting burned out. And so now we need to seek out grants or other form of support. And they do a kind of scattershot. Let's just do a ton of different contracts and different grants. And what ends up happening is then they've promised things, and now they have to figure out how to deliver it. And it's very reactionary instead of planning ahead to say, okay, which of these contracts actually fit into what we're doing and expand it in a strategic way. I've worked in nonprofits where it was like, okay, the new program of the week is this. Everybody work on that, and off we go and try to madly try to meet the contract requirements, when in fact, you know, it should be, you know, a very thoughtful process of where to go. And it can be very confusing, I think, for nonprofits, especially smaller ones that don't have, you know, kind of more management to just sit and think about how do we do this and how do we do this well.
Katie, don't you find that there are stages in the evolution of nonprofits that most of them are birthed because there's a particular passion that I like to say an activist passion, where someone's literally going to get out there and try and make a difference in the world, and they're using their passion and their time and their elbow grease to make that difference in the world, and then if they succeed, the next stage is, oops, they literally outgrew themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think with nonprofits that start with a couple of people, you know, that they're very passion-driven, they definitely have an idea of their mission and for the world and specific issue that they're going to address, and so they get out and do it. And really, when you're very first starting, there's planning, and I think some people I've met people that have been very successful at being strategic, and I've met people that haven't. but you start planning, and then as you grow, as you get some funding or as you, you know, get some donations, you bring in people to do stuff. And I think this happens in for-profits as well, but as you get to a certain size, you have to hire people, so you have to know how to do that, and not necessarily, not everybody knows how to do that, and so they hire people that then don't work out. They may have passion, but they don't have the ability to do the work. But then once you get to a certain size, you have to really figure out who's going to do what. How do we make sure that we've got everything in compliance with all these contracts that we've got, or with, you know, what this donor expects or what that contract expects? And it gets to a place where, you know, a lot of people are wearing a lot of hats. Things get confusing. And that's when efficiency becomes a huge deal, because growth, I think, truly is more exponential than just a straight line. And so once you get to a certain point, you have to really tighten down your practices. And I think oftentimes that gets really hard, because it's like, this is my baby. I started it. I want to do all the pieces. Maybe I'll delegate this thing because I don't like it. But mostly I just want to do it because I've been doing it. And it can be very hard to then let some of those pieces go to other people to say, okay, I'm going to give this part to you. I'm going to give that part to you. And we're going to figure out this team structure thing so that we are in compliance with everything. We're doing the service that we want to do, and we're making sure that we're not going to get in trouble. You know, whether it's not having enough staff to do the services that you said you would, whether it's not having, you know, enough people that are doing the work the right way. I know, you know, especially with the new regulations that's come into place, there's a lot more oversight. And so it's something where you have to have, you know, a lot of pieces working together successfully in order to really continue forward past that kind of oops phase.
Right. You know, I just got a text from someone saying they don't see how something as enormous, gigantic as the Getty Foundation and its trust in any way relates to what we're talking about. But just to explain to our listeners, the Getty Foundation was built by an enormous pot of wealth because of the oil reserves that kept being found by the Getty Oil Company in all of its various names. But the profits were being put in trust, the family profits. And the way that trust was written is that every year, 5% of the foundation had to be used for art acquisition. If you think about one company, one player in the world having multi-millions of dollars a year that because of the way the trust was written, it had to be spent. It was not an option. It had to be spent on art. What happened is that they were going out to every auction and every private collection and buying art. And so the challenge it was creating a tremendous upheaval in the art world because nobody else could outbid them. They had this giant endless pot of money that had to be spent. And so what they came to recognize was they were going to completely disrupt art being available for other museums, other collections, other galleries. And they had to go and fight some legal battles, which fortunately they succeeded in order to get the wording to include the building of the entire Getty Center in Los Angeles. So what they were able to do, I will say bluntly, is divert where they were spending their money from the acquisition of art to the building of a phenomenal art center, its structure, its infrastructure, and so on, to house and curate collections. And so they were able to stave off their impact in this world that, you know, John Getty's passion was art. That's great. But the way the trust was written was completely disruptive in the world. And you would think, well, it's the best thing in the world to have all the money in the world to go towards your cause. But no, you can actually be quite disruptive. So you have to be as strategic and business-minded in that setting as when you're trying to do mental health, when you're trying to do any other nonprofit. And I love the example that Gina came up with, you know, with the Gridiron Trust Foundation and its goals and its efforts, is this very fine balancing act between meeting the donor's cause requirements, reporting, and so on, and figuring out how you're going to organize yourself to actually be able to deliver on the business of your business, which happens to be under a nonprofit umbrella.
Absolutely.
So when you go in and work with companies nowadays, is there a particular starting point that you're using? And I say companies, businesses, nonprofits, all the same.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that we've been talking generally, but each nonprofit, each company is different, of course. And so I feel like, and as a therapist, I've been trained in assessment, and that's how I always start, you know, on that end. And so for me, I really appreciate going in and just seeing what's going on, assessing how is the team working, how strategic are things, how efficient are things, what are the dreams of the frontline staff, looking at, you know, what are the next steps for this business, because I think you can't obviously come in and assume something, and sometimes the CEOs or the board or the folks that are running the show may not know what it is that's going on, but they know they want something different. And so I come in and I assess what's going on. And that leads to obviously a very unique individualized plan. What's the next step? Is it management training? Is it strategic planning? Is it, you know, kind of employee engagement work? Because oftentimes I find in nonprofits, your frontline staff come in passionate, but they, you know, they end up burning out because there's so much to be done and so little money. And so are you utilizing all your resources, including human resources, well enough to support your mission? And so it can look a lot of different ways. It can look like, you know, a strategic planning meeting with a small group of people, with a slightly larger group of people. It can be individual coaching. It can be a specific kind of training around employee engagement and helping folks out. But it really starts for me with an assessment of what's going on and really talking to as many of the team members as I can, because each person has such a different perspective of what's going on. And you can really, especially if the perspectives line up, you know that the communication is good. If they don't line up, then there's, you know, some communication around how we work, what the mission is, what the activities are that support the mission, and, you know, and what the next steps are, because I think it's so important for the visionaries to be able to communicate their vision and really get everybody on board moving forward towards it. Because oftentimes, as I said just a second ago, you know, employees within nonprofits can get burnt out really quickly because so much to do, so little money. So you're, you know, and then there's that kind of expectation that you're going to work a lot of hours because you're doing this because you love it. And so that, I don't know that we can ever really change. I think, you know, I think that there is a way to try to create reasonable salaries and reasonable work hours, but there's, you know, obviously there's a limit to that, and you can't avoid that people are going to be so passionate about what they do that they're willing to give up their weekend for it. But I think if you can engage them in the mission, in the work, so they feel respected, that their work is meaningful, all of those things, and you can really move towards a team that's willing to go the extra mile and not feel bitter about it. Because I've seen a lot of people on the front lines, and at one point I was one of those people that was like, I'm doing all the work. I'm the one that's bringing in the money, and I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling used and abused because there's, you know, only so much money to go around, and, you know, there's a lot of different places, you know, especially when there's inefficiency, there's a lot of different places where it gets spent, except on my salary and my benefits. So it's really looking to see where would my efforts be best utilized to help the team take the next step. And I really like to start at a place of, is everything efficient? Are people doing things that make sense? Are people working towards their strengths? And then once things are running really smoothly, then start thinking creatively and innovatively, because I think a lot of times that's what people are there for. They're there to continue to provide these great services, and you know, society changes, ideas change, and so to be able to actually have time to think and plan because everything's become so efficient is a wonderful place to be. But then once you start the creativity process, it gets messy again, so you have to fold that back into the efficiency and kind of training them on that process of the brainstorming, the strategic planning, and the accountability that actually has things, you know, so people follow through with things is super exciting. So I think I kind of went off on a little tangent there, but that's kind of how I work.
I love what you were just sharing, because it is a repeating cycle. Innovation's as important in a nonprofit as it is in a for-profit business. New ways of perceiving what's happening in the marketplace, what new opportunities that might be, what new opportunities for sources of funding, let alone uses of funding, and then the company, the business, the nonprofit staff and team and systems and processes to be able to deliver and create the flow from donor through the system to the recipient at the other end. It's mm-hmm. so critical. And just having fixed the system once or created a really effective and efficient system once means now you've created a new foundation to go out and innovate from again, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it can be easy to think, okay, we've got everything smooth, let's move on. That's easy. But especially, I think one of the sayings, and it's a cliche, so everybody's heard it, but one of the sayings that floats around in nonprofits frequently is the only constant is change, because the political landscape changes, the economy changes, so you might have donors or contracts at this amount 1 year, and next year it completely, you know, donors can't afford to donate anymore, or contracts get adjusted, or, you know, there's a new evidence-based practice or a new, you know, pet project at the county, state, or federal level. And so all of a sudden, this program that you've spent a whole year developing and growing now has half the budget, but you have a new program that you have to develop that has three times the budget. So the nonprofit overall is getting more money, but you have to then adjust people and processes and all of that stuff in order to match the new makeup of your money. And so it's important to constantly be aware, because if you're just barely getting by and reacting and chasing the crisis of the day, you're not going to be able to be strategic when these new funds come or when you lose funds and have an opportunity to get other funds. There was a huge shift, for example, after 2008, I think it was 2009 or 2010, when it actually hit the county level government funding. And there was Medi-Cal, all of a sudden there was a huge portion of services that just went away. Like, it was just gone. The money was gone. There was nothing there. And so, you know, nonprofits that maybe had, you know, $11 million, $14 million budget, all of a sudden had $5 million just gone. I mean, it was frightening. And the county was able to work together with the folks that they were talking to and said, okay, we found this other pot of money, but this is how we utilize this pot of money. It's a slightly different type of service. And it was an amazing countywide collaboration to figure out how do we get this pot of money. But it was something where the vice president of clinical programs that I was working with was extremely flexible and agile in looking at the budget, looking at the opportunities. And the agency I was working with actually ended up with a higher budget after all the pieces fell down than before. But it was, you know, huge transformation, a lot of planning around, you know, we have to try these new methods, we have to do this type of money, we have to set up our divisions differently. I mean, it was gigantic change. But because it was, okay, we're going to plan instead of react, we ended up better off. It was pretty amazing. But there was other agencies that had to close their doors because they couldn't get their mind around, okay, now I've got to completely change how I do things.
You put your finger on such a critical idea for our listeners, which is that inside of the nonprofit arena, success in so many ways is dependent on innovation and entrepreneurial thinking. We think of those terms mostly out in the for-profit world or the tech world or complex problem solving in some sophisticated business enterprise. And the irony is it's a day-in, day-out annual issue inside of nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It would be quite remarkable if somehow the message got out in society that if you are highly innovative and continuously looking for challenges, that ironically the nonprofit world might be a really perfect place for you to spend your time using your intelligence and your skills and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that folks think nonprofit and think, oh, that means that you don't make any money. But in truth, it means that the overall budget is supposed to end up meeting zero. And so people get salaries, and sometimes, you know, depending on the nonprofit, it could be a tiny salary or it could be a nice salary. But it doesn't mean that there's not money moving around. You know, the chief financial officers for some of the larger nonprofits have large budgets that they're having to manage, and it's you know, a lot of money moving around. It's a lot of different types of contracts with a lot of different types of parameters, and so they have a very intense job. and then there's also, you know, the folks that are adjusting to where's the funding coming from, what's the new thing that we want to try out that will support instead of throw off our current programming. I mean, there's so many different pieces that are a lot more complicated than you might expect. And it takes a lot of intelligence. It takes a lot of creativity. And I think it really takes passion for what you're doing because it's a whirlwind. Absolutely. It's a whirlwind of excitement, and flexibility and creativity are so key to working in a nonprofit.
I remember years ago there was, it was around 2008 when so many companies underwent shocks and resizing, and a lot of executives were flushed out of their jobs. And I remember so many of them saying, not a problem, I'm going to go put myself in the not-for-profit world. I'm going to go contribute my business know-how to the nonprofit world because they're so inefficient. They need me. Mm-hmm. But very few of them were still in those roles 2 years later. They did not understand the dynamics of the nonprofit world, and in some ways, the conceit that they came in the door with actually didn't serve the nonprofit. It wasn't helpful.
Well, and I think that that's the biggest thing that I think folks that have never been in the not-for-profit world don't understand. The people within the not-for-profits at every level are so driven by passion that they really balk moves towards efficiency unless there's a right spin on it, because I don't want to be a cog in a machine. That's why I'm in the not-for-profit world. I don't want to see my job in a larger role, in a larger team necessarily, because I'm out here doing this because I love it and because I have something to offer and I'm helping people. I've had many conversations where I had to really adjust perspectives about, okay, yes, we are all out there because we love doing this. But let's make our jobs easier by figuring out how we can make this more efficient. Let's figure out how we can get spend more time working with our clients and less time doing all the different pieces, and make that part a machine so that you can then be free to do the services for the people that you want to do. But saying like, oh, you just got to meet productivity, or oh, you've got to just do this, or oh, you got to just do that, you know, where businesses are like, here's the accountability and this is what you must do and everybody's replaceable, is like poison to the people that are working in nonprofits when it's really their passion and their love. They can't get their mind around, I need to be productive. They're like, well, but I'm barely making any money and I'm doing this wonderful thing for these people. It's like, no, but we can help you make more money and see more people and do all these things if you do the procedures this way. But it's a hard sell. It's a really hard sell unless they start seeing success with, oh, if I can delegate this, or oh, if I can do this one thing, it makes it more efficient for me. Once they start seeing that, they can shift it around. But coming with a hardline business model of, you know, either get on the bus or get off, there's a lot of pushback. And I think there's been a shift to more of a business mindset. A lot of the titles changed to, you know, from, you know, executive director to CEO. And so I think there's been a shift that's been going on in the nonprofits that I've been working with. But thing where frontline staff, are they really push back. They don't like to be seen as in business or in a corporate environment. They see themselves really as doing something that is from their heart. And if they get a salary, great.
Yeah, perhaps what's needed is a whole new category of titles so that they can be used to have the folks who are members of this community, the employees, the frontline folks, get a kind of title that allows them to want to think about innovation and productivity and so on without it mapping directly to the, quote, for-profit corporate identities.
I think that it probably would be helpful, and I think even just, you know, some of the different words we've thrown around are more for shorthand and wouldn't necessarily be used in the not-for-profit world. But for me, it's really a mindset shift. I mean, I had a couple of different teams that I worked with where it really was just figuring out what motivates them to this work and how do I support that motivation while also supporting making things more efficient, making things work better, maximizing the contract. And it's almost about translating it into the words that make sense to them so that they will do what they need to do. And sometimes it's just a cold, hard fact. If we don't bill this, we're not going to be able to do these services next year. So we need to figure out how we can bill more of it. But oftentimes it's, okay, how much time are you actually spending working with the people that you want to serve? Well, maybe it's half time. Maybe it's a quarter time. Okay, we want you to spend more time doing that. So we want to make everything else efficient so you can do the piece that's really important and that you love, and everything else still gets done. And that, I think, is a different mindset than you have to meet productivity. You have to bill enough. And I think that being able to kind of go back and forth, setting accountability, but also really talking about the mission and the motivation that's driving people to do what they need to do is so important. Because they're not there to be business worker bees. They're there because they want to serve.
So, Linda, let's remind everyone of where they can find our wonderful guest, Katie Vernoy.
So the best place for them to go is on the internet to katievernoy.com. That's KATIEVERNOY, katievernoy.com. And you'll be able to find out all about the work that Katie does. And if you're on the board of a nonprofit, if you're a volunteer in a nonprofit, if you're an employee of a nonprofit, if you're part of management of a nonprofit, I really encourage you to reach out to her and find out about how she might be able to help you. You know, Gina, you and I talk so often about creating leverage in business. It's the same thing in a nonprofit, isn't it?
Absolutely. Leverage is leverage, and no matter what kind of business it is, they should be looking for how to maximize leverage. Without it, they're going to be working harder for smaller results over a longer period of time. And even when nonprofits are doing things based on passion, they really are doing it because they want the biggest possible results, not the smallest, aren't they?
Absolutely. They want to have a big result. They want to have a big impact.
Absolutely. And in my world, that means maximize leverage every place you turn.
Mm-hmm. So important.
So in our last minute, Katie, what advice do you have for our listeners today? We've got a lot of nonprofits listening, I'm sure.
Well, I think for nonprofits, I think it's taking a moment to just reflect, when is the last time you were able to plan strategically and didn't feel like you were running around with a chicken with your head cut off, chasing the crisis of the day, just trying to get the things cleared off your desk? Because if you can sit down and plan strategically for even an hour, it can greatly impact your ability to do the work for the people that you want to serve.
Well, thank you so much for all that you've shared. This has been a fantastic show today. Thanks, Linda, as well. And Linda and I will be back same time, same place next week here for another episode of Breakthrough Directions on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great week, everybody. Thank you so much,
guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Katie. It was great having you.
Join us Tuesday at noon Eastern for the next episode of Breakthrough Directions. From relationship marketing to business success.